You're listening to part 2 of episode 638 of Unwelcome Guests. We continue with National Lampoon's Deteriorata, written by Tony Hendra in 1972.
You are
placidly amid the noise and waste, and remember what comfort there may be in owning a piece thereof. Avoid quiet and passive persons unless you are in need of sleep. Rotate your tires. Speak glowingly of those greater than yourself, and heed well their advice, even though they be turkeys. Know what to kiss and when. Consider that two wrongs never make a right, but that three do. Wherever possible, put people on hold. Be comforted that in the face of all aridity and disillusionment, and despite the changing fortunes of time, there is always a big future in computer maintenance. Remember the Pueblo. Strive at all times to bend, fold, spindle, and mutilate. Know yourself. If you need help, call the FBI. Exercise caution in your daily affairs, especially with those persons closest to you. That lemon on your left, for instance. Be assured that a walk through the ocean of most souls would scarcely get your feet wet. Fall not in love, therefore. It will stick to your face. Gracefully surrender the things of youth, birds, clean air, tuna, Taiwan, and let not the sands of time get in your lunch. Hire people with hooks. For a good time, call 606-4311. Ask for Ken. Take heart amid the deepening gloom that your dog is finally getting enough cheese. And reflect that whatever misfortune may be your lot, it could only be worse in Milwaukee.
You are a fluke of the universe.
You are a fluke of the universe. You have no right to be here. And whether you can hear it or not, the universe is laughing behind your back. Therefore, make peace with your God, whatever you conceive him to be, hairy thunderer or cosmic muffin. With all its hopes, dreams, promises, and urban renewal, the world continues to deteriorate. Give up.
You are a
Now, never let it be said that we don't have some breaks between all the serious stuff on this show. And now we're going to hear a radio adaptation of the film Consumed, The Human Experience. Rather than looking at possible futures for humanity, as Gabor Maté does, looking at problems in the psyche, how addiction rages amongst people trying to fill an inner void. We're looking at how the modern inner void got carefully engineered. Yes, Charles Eisenstein masterfully does that in his book, The Center of Humanity. Highly recommended if you're new to the show. But that's a bit of a long-term perspective. So, in order to understand where citizens of the so-called developed world are at, thinking particularly about citizens in general, rather than unwelcome guest listeners, but nevertheless, it's very hard to avoid that influence if you live in a society. You've got to share space with people who are busy concerned about brands and images and so on. So we're going to hear this film, which is available for download. If you want to watch it, I'll post it on the website, so it'll probably be there by the time you hear this. That's unwelcomeguests.net/638. It looks at how carefully consumer culture has been engineered, how understandings of evolution and psychology have been interwoven with brands, marketing strategies, sort of hijack people's natural responses. I've thought for a long time that just as companies shouldn't be allowed to externalize their pollution and would have to pay for cleanup costs, then a similar sort of phenomenon on a mental level would be appropriate, whereby they pay for the damage they did to people's psyche. But no, I'm not expecting that to actually happen. I don't think the powers that be are very interested in compensating people for having wrecked their life through advertisements, just as I don't think the concept of money itself is one which can provide a solution to the dislocation and the breaking down of connections between people and between people in the natural world.
Perhaps the most incredible story of the last million years is the rise of modern human culture. The cities we populate and the lives that we lead. It is the world that our children will inherit. But after a century of exponential growth in population and consumerism, people are questioning the nature of modern life, beginning to doubt our motivations and predicting environmental destruction. This film uses evolutionary psychology as a tool to look at modern society. In understanding human nature, our current concerns look smaller, more transient, with potentially a solution.
Consumed. Inside the belly of the beast.
We've all got this weird mental illness called consumerism. We've all kind of gone collectively psychotic. Chasing status in public with people who don't really care and neglecting your own lovers and friends and neighbors and kids.
Jeffrey Miller, professor of psychology.
You know, that this consumption of material items as a means to acquire status is as much of a trap as it is a set of freedoms.
Jonathan Chapman, reader in architecture and design.
This pervasive nature of it is perhaps crossed a threshold of us being able to cope with it and process the information. The high street is actually a stressful, anxious place. We're getting very little from it, but working incredibly hard to try and figure it all out.
We have the delusion that we really have deep insight into ourselves already. We're very sophisticated now in the early 21st century, but we're going to seem incredibly naive in another 100 years. Our grandchildren will think, what were they on about? Why did they care about brands and having 6-bedroom houses if they're only one married couple and one kid? Why did they care about that?
There is a lot of baggage and meaning attached to the word consumer and consumerism. But for all the negative connotations, consumerism and consumptive processes are merely descriptive words for something that feels very normal for the human animal to do.
Jonathan Chapman, author of Emotionally Durable Design.
They're the result of a very natural human urge to experience and to grow and to learn and to play out dreams and ambitions and aspirations. And in that respect, consumption can be seen as something incredibly natural and incredibly normal for a stimulus-hungry species such as ours to do. And as we now know what clouds are, we know what thunder is, we know why plants grow, as things become increasingly understood, the need for mystery and experience and magic is still there, but we need to kind of synthesize and make ways of experiencing that.
I just wish I had a decent kitchen.
In a subtle and satisfying way, this consumption of products and experiences has now also become a significant measure for our lives.
There is this story that we're all very aware of, but no one ever sat us down and told us the story. But we kind of understand, through media in many ways, we understand that landscape and where the milestones are. For example, your first double bed, buying your first cot. I don't think it's necessarily production and consumption that's driving that. It's just that this is a human process and it's a human way of structuring and creating sense out of the future, which is totally unknown. The difference is that we've chosen to structure it and signpost it with products and possessions.
This is my daughter, Jessie, passing one of her milestones, riding a bike without stabilisers.
Come in. Come on.
This is Alex, my son, taking his first steps. They are hungry for experience, and living in a highly developed society, the means to feed this hunger is unlimited. The planet has been turned into a playground for us all. Our lives have never been richer, yet our need for more seems undiminished. Growth has become fetishized, but more money, more holidays, more work, more choice, more stuff in more houses is pushing us to the limit.
I think if you took a prehistoric human and transferred them into the modern world, they would be really surprised that we aren't happier than we are. They would think, you're living in a golden age and you're sort of squandering it on all these silly anxieties.
Addictions, depression, and mental health issues are becoming part of everyday conversation. We are losing ourselves in the rush, struggling to keep our head above water.
The idea that we're sense-hungry or stimulus searchers, I think we've made ourselves that way by developing a contemporary experiential landscape where the majority of problems are already solved. There's actually nothing for us to do.
There's not just the individual financial and psychological cost of modern culture. There is also an environmental cost. And in a rigorous study, behavioural scientist Warren Hearn found the human race is acting like a cancer on the planet, displaying all the four major characteristics of a malignant process. Ultimately, cancer kills the organism that supports it.
Tim Cooper, Professor of Sustainable Design and Consumption.
I think it's become increasingly clear that the kind of growth rates that we're getting around the world, 10% plus in countries like China and India, a norm of 2 or 3% in most industrialised countries, can't be sustained. The sheer throughput of materials, energy, resources that are finite, most of them, that cannot continue into the long term.
The philosopher John Gray concludes the human population can only be maintained by desolating the Earth, creating an era of solitude in which little remains of the planet but us and the prosthetic environment that keeps us alive.
In Britain, the average household is consuming as if there were three planets rather than one.
You can see that this very natural human process is beginning to mutate into something toxic and negative.
There's a quote from Marshall McLuhan: "There are no passengers on spaceship Earth. We are all crew."
Modern society is the story of our age, for good or evil. Scientists, philosophers, and psychologists have been looking at the evolution of the human species in an attempt to understand our meteoric rise and our recent detachment from the environment.
Alistair McIntosh, Professor of Human Ecology.
I think that the only way we are different from other animals is in the type of consciousness that we have got. Consider that we have only been walking around on this Earth as Homo sapiens for 200,000 years, which is nothing in geological term. Reminds us that we're just babies on the planet. And so we're on a very steep learning curve.
Can we have my story now?
Evolutionary theory says we have built in our genes two prime subconscious motivators: survival and attracting a mate. The principal tool humans use to fulfill both of these needs is the brain. Our brain has tripled in size since we evolved from primates. It is what makes us unique as animals, and research suggests if we understand the mechanisms of the brain, we begin to understand our whole culture, consumerist or otherwise.
Most animals run around worrying about three things: food, predators, and grooming themselves to get rid of parasites and infectious disease. Once we've taken care of that, once we have agriculture to produce food, once we've shot and killed all the predators around us, and once we've got sanitation and medicine to take care of infectious disease largely, we can turn our minds towards those other obsessions: social status and sexual attractiveness. So we spend a lot more time thinking about that and obsessing about those issues, social and sexual issues, than probably any other animals I've had the luxury of doing before in the history of life on Earth. Most of our ornaments are mental and behavioral, and that's mostly what we're showing off in courtship. We don't really flash huge tails like peacocks. We don't use that much sexual coercion compared to other species. So we're relatively peaceful, we're relatively naked, and we do most of our courtship through language. And showing off our brain capacities, like our intelligence, personality, moral virtues, burning the calories in your brain to produce a good sense of humor, or to sing well, or to produce interesting art, or to show off your creativity in any of the natural human ways that we've evolved to do. In modern consumerist culture, all of that effort, all of that status-seeking effort, all of the mating effort is now channeled into the economy. It's channeled into the goods and services that we buy. So the principal way you're supposed to display your mental traits now is through your purchases. The economy tries to capture all of our mating effort into these goods and services and turn them into our props for mating.
Products have therefore become a means of promoting ourselves beyond the talking. We use them as a signal. The foundations for this behaviour were laid down hundreds of thousands of years ago as we evolved a cultural trait called prestige.
I'm a Plude, reader in archaeology.
The big difference between humans and other animals in terms of rankings and social status is that they don't have what I'm going to define as prestige. They have social status rankings, some are higher status than others, but all of that status, the relative positioning of one to another, is determined by dominance behaviors. So violence, threat of violence, coercion. only humans have what I'm going to call prestige, and that is respect or authority or social power that is freely granted from one individual to another. The desire for prestige is Darwinistic in the sense that it probably has been selected for during the course of human evolution. Certainly, since it's something we don't share with other primate species, that desire for prestige, and then perhaps the signaling component as well, is something that's emerged over the course of human history. And I would say that it's done so because it's adaptive. As you say, it confers a benefit, getting increased goods, services, respect, authority from others has got to have benefits. Therefore, natural selection over time has shaped our psychologies and our behaviors in such a way that we both desire prestige and act in ways to try and acquire it.
There is one more important factor to consider. Because the brain's capacity has evolved to be the most crucial component in the survival and development of the human species, it has an inbuilt predisposition for growth. We are naturally driven to stimulate it. It is why we feel boredom so acutely, why we are so mentally restless. Our huge brain capacity is what makes us unique among animals, and in its simplest form, consumption is nourishment. And so brain food is part of our daily diet.
Led by the assistant, the family procession forms to enter the vestibule of the church, where the rector and crucifer await the Episcopal service.
It is fair to say our survival instinct and need for personal growth and prestige has been, up until recent times, the principal driver for society to evolve. Harnessing the brain's ingenuity, it has led from the agricultural revolution to the industrial revolution, from wind and water power to fossil fuel and nuclear power, from economic activity that started local and is now global. The natural need to secure a future for ourselves, our children, and our species has accelerated at a startling pace, with huge success. We're the only species that changes where we live to suit us, and when we have a good idea, it spreads. If we now look at modern society, we can see how capitalism not only reflects our evolutionary tendencies, but also amplifies and distorts it. Marketing is like the air we breathe. It's all around us. Marketing gurus have learned how to push our evolutionary buttons. They know status is a psychological pressure point, as is our need to promote our intelligence, creativity, and emotional stability. It means that by 20, the average Westerner has seen 1 million commercial messages, and budgets for advertising for kids has risen to over $1 billion. We are now indoctrinated to consume from birth.
A quote from the CEO of Prism Communications: they aren't children so much as what I call evolving consumers.
Modern sales techniques were born at the front end of the 20th century. Sigmund Freud's nephew, Edward Bernays, was living in America, and after success working as an agent, he was put in charge of propaganda as America entered the Great War in 1916. He was so successful that when peace came, he believed that if people's opinions could be moulded at a time of war, then why not while at peace? He coined the phrase public relations and set about getting people to buy stuff. Fundamental in his approach was the use of aspirational marketing. At the request of corporations, worried that people would stop buying once they had everything for a comfortable life, Bonnet set about making consumerism the way we show both our success and our personality.
Alistair McIntosh, Professor of Human Ecology.
The corporations, especially in the mid-20th century, were actively looking at the way they could trigger off psychological impulses deep within us that would cause us to desire new products that we had never ever thought of desiring before. So in that respect, it's pushed upon us. But it's only possible to do that because, as Microsoft would put it, there are security vulnerabilities within us.
The 1950s saw consumerism come of age, a golden era where scientists, inventors, designers, and corporations competed to meet the desires of the ever-hungry people. Marketing culture was everywhere, and with the dominance of Hollywood films and the invention of television, it wasn't long before the rest of the world got to witness how comfortable the other half lived.
See it? Isn't it beautiful?
If I only had a car like that, I'd really be popular. Everybody would want to be friends with me then.
Jeffrey Miller, author of The Mating Mind.
One critical thing that advertising does is it tries to convince consumers that above average products can compensate for below average traits.
Shirt right, tie right, and coat right. Can't be popular unless you know how to dress.
So that if you're not that funny, you're not that verbally creative, you're not artistic, you don't have any of the romantic skills that are naturally attractive, you can compensate, don't worry. You can get the engineering degree, make a respectable living, buy a bunch of stuff, and still be viable and attractive on the mating market. I think that's a delusion. It doesn't actually work. You might attract a spouse for a while, but they'll get bored with you, and they'll leave you, and they'll divorce you, and they'll go looking for somebody else who's more interesting. So what's happening now is consumers are neglecting to develop the crucial romantically attractive traits. Saying, I've got a Porsche out front, it might interest people of the opposite sex at a kind of superficial level, but it doesn't really pack the emotional punch that leads people to fall in love with you as a person.
Psychology research supports this argument. It has found that in studying marketing for music, while we are sold the idea it is cool to listen to certain bands, being a mediocre singer or musician is a lot more romantically attractive.
Leaving, going home. Leaving.
I mean, the advertising is trying to insinuate itself into the kids and the teenagers and the youthful consumers at an ever younger age. And it's realized, for example, that if you sexualize young teens, if you make them think about mating earlier and earlier, you can capture more of their money or more of their parents' money.
I don't know.
A brand as a family or as a collective is a wonderful thing. You get to assign membership to a group that has a certain value set and an image and profile that you kind of like the feel of. But at the same time, you get to be an individual within that group. But what's also interesting, you know, if everything costs about the same, the brand is kind of everything.
I think the marketing revolution is convincing every consumer that you've got to be the center of your own world. You've got to be an ardent narcissist. As people withdraw into themselves and devote all their effort into social status and attracting mates, in the process of that, they often kind of forget to reproduce at all. They lose the Darwinian plot.
Will she still hold me in her arms? I don't know.
I'm a Plood, reader in archaeology.
I think to a certain extent our, if you will, our evolved predispositions to seek status, to desire prestige, are operating in a context now that is very, very different from the one in which they originally evolved.
We talk about the man-made and what we think of as motorways and buildings and Phillips screws, but actually the man-made is also the meanings and values and systems and social structures that come with all of that. When you look into an electronics store and you look at black, shiny digital gadgets which are aimed at a particular person who's looking to wear that superhero costume and become the organized busy person. That's what that prop is. It's not a product, it's a prop. That's what that is for. It's a way for you to self-actualize and fulfill that need. Feeling like you're part of the iPod generation is also a kind of shelter, because by acquiring the product and putting the headphones in and walking the street in that way, you become part of a group and you're safe now, grounded within something that's perhaps real.
Here's the biggest TV advertising campaign ever seen in the history of the stocking business. We're going to sell stockings of Agilon yarn to millions and millions of women from coast to coast through repetitive selling and exciting TV commercials. Here's a preview.
It's new, 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 and true for you.
We have become lost in this modern landscape, living
Alistair
to consume.
McIntosh, author of
Consumerism isn't a
water.
Conspiracy. It is very much a reflection of the human mind. And this is why we find it so comforting.
When you've got an emptiness inside you that is basically insatiable, because you've never dealt with the real cause of that emptiness. And as with any addiction, you keep on stuffing that emptiness full of stuff that can't satisfy.
You know, the IKEA truck kind of drives away and you realize that, well, you're still the same person. You've just got all this stuff now. And I think that maybe it's that kind of realization that what you thought was going to happen hasn't happened. In which sense, we're barking up the wrong tree if we're looking for meaning and satisfaction through material consumption.
I think marketing has very little effect on the fundamental parts of human nature. It's not really changing the structure of the brain or the nature of human intelligence or personality. But marketing's having a huge effect on the way people think about themselves, on the kinds of display strategies that they learn and that they invest in. And in that sense, it's very, very powerful. I think marketing is really at the heart of modern 21st century culture.
Consumerism is another example of virtual reality. And the problem with so much of where we're at just now is that we've allowed virtual reality to become more than just a game.
Concentrate on the forehead now. We can feel the tension there. Keep relaxing and value the ability to make your mind a blank.
Do these things to untense, and we will approach each day with a better outlook, poised, relaxed. That's the way to let yourself go and have a better time going.
The environmental effects of unfettered consumption are well documented. But if we are to lead our children to a more hopeful future, we need to understand how psychologically we have become untouched by destructiveness.
I think that we become dissociated from the world when we move out of relationship with hands-on experience of elemental reality, of fire, air, earth, and water. And when everything gets served up to us on a plate, because we've got a highly mechanized, computerized, globalized supply system in which we have lost touch with where things are coming from in the natural living world. And as a result of that losing touch, we're no longer able to care so much because we just don't feel it the same way.
The irony is, as human technology and history progress, we get increased mastery over the environment. With the agricultural revolution, instead of having to wander around for miles looking for hunted meat and berries and fruits and nuts, we focus just on our little patch of farmed land. We plow it. We get a reliable food supply. With the industrial revolution, you withdraw even further into your little bourgeois house. And what you care about are the mechanisms that surround you, the refrigerators, washing machines, you know, the telephones, all of that. Now your reach is greatly extended. You have more technical control over the environment with the Industrial Revolution. With the Marketing Revolution, you withdraw even further into yourself, and you just worry about the brands that surround you. You're not even worried about the technology anymore. You don't know how the plumbing works. You don't know how your car works. You just know what kind of car it is, what kind of refrigerator you've got. So there's a gradual withdrawal of focus from the environment at large into yourself and your own narrative.
It seems our ignorance of how nature works and what it does for us is exacting a terrible price. More people are chasing fewer resources. Food production is near the limits of growth. Oil has reached its peak. The world's population will pass 9 billion by 2050. Strong nations are reaching into weak nations to take what they need. Forests are cut down and the oceans emptied. Biodiversity is already collapsing. But as long as our economies continue to grow, we pretend not to notice. We're like the people on Easter Island, enthralled to our culture, throwing up structures that prove our mastery, ignoring the damage we are doing to the planet we share. We've always done it, only now we have reached the limits of what the planet can provide. Can the science of sustainability save us from this ongoing destructive tendency?
I would see sustainability as simply the ability for our species, human species, to survive long term in its environment without damaging the carrying capacity of that environment, the capacity of the environment to support what is there.
I think that the issue of time is crucial to this. We've got this very short-term mindset, and part of sustainability has got to go as far as changing that psychological mindset towards a culture of permanence for not next few years, not next few decades, but for hundreds of years, thousands of years. It's no good just saying, oh, we'll put a label on the product and say it's a bit greener than the other product and expect everyone to start buying the right thing. The problem goes deeper than that.
Jonathan Chapman, reader in architecture and design.
If you go to a waste recycling centre and you look at what's there, you will find that, particularly with electronic products, actually, which is e-waste, if you like, you'll find that what's there generally works. In a utilitarian sense, it still does what it was meant to do. Computers still compute, fridges still make stuff cold. And I think what it throws into light is that there are different kinds of durability, and that other things have broken, like desire can break, fascination can break, mystery can break, things can lose mystery and lose fiction very quickly. And all of these fantile property that advertisers use very cleverly can break. They can die out, they can fade away. And so the challenge, the intervention, if you like, is about looking at ways of designing products and marketing products and consuming products that have a sustainable kind of meaning and a very durable set of values and desires, so that we perhaps don't fall out of love with them so quickly. Like the way a pair of denim jeans, for example, picks up patina and age through use, or may contain rips or stains which only the owner really knows what they're about. And that links back then, of course, to narrative.
We're only going to actually address sustainable consumption properly as a society, as communities. Individuals can do so much, but ultimately we'll just lose hope, and we'll find it just too much like hard work for us to bear that burden of having to do the right thing when we go shopping all the time. We need to complement the small step changes that individuals do with a bigger vision that ultimately can only be introduced by far-sighted industry people. Needs industry to think about new business models as well, so that their profits in future don't depend on selling cheap throwaway rubbish, but in fact their profitability is built into providing products that last, and maybe their profits are partly dependent on them providing us a good service to keep those goods in service for longer.
Large producers are saying, we would now like to consider making products that people want to keep for longer. We know how to make a washing machine that works for 30 years. We know how to do that. But what we don't know how to do is to design a washing machine that somebody wants to keep for 30 years, because we haven't trained consumers to consume that way. And there is a shift, and there are changes happening, and design, sustainable design, if you like, is at one of the edges of that shift.
I think that the politics of sustainability is only one part of it. There's the old feminist maxim that the personal is the political is the personal, and you need both sides of that. You need to look at what a human being is, what our inner lives are about, in order to understand what the potentialities for political change can be.
Major presidential candidates vote like all the other citizens. One of them in New York City describes himself as a lawyer. The other, up in the country where his home is, gives his occupation as farmer.
Drawn to power and prestige, politicians display all the traits that have got us into this mess in the first place. The very competitiveness of their nature marries perfectly with modern society, and they are unlikely to find the answers we need.
I'm a Plude reader in archaeology.
Sadly, when you think of security, you think of like how many resources do we have in the world, and certainly there's plenty to provide for all, and it seems odd that we have so much striving and insecurity, given that's true. But social status is sort of a zero-sum game. No matter if you live on the richest island or the poorest island in the world, your social group will always have a low-ranking person and a high-ranking person and everyone in between. So there's always a context for that striving to be higher status, because it's a relative condition to the whole group. And we are, I think, shaped by evolution to desire to be higher status.
Our brains are programmed for survival, prestige, and above all, growth. And we have created a society that reflects and facilitates this. Humanity and its grip on the environment will continue to grow until everything the planet has to offer is consumed. It is just how evolution works.
Alistair McIntosh, Professor of Human Ecology.
You know, I was giving a talk in America, and afterwards somebody came up to me and he said, let me tell you a story. He said, I used to be a hippie back in the days when hippies were real hippies. And two of my hippie friends wanted to go to Cuba to meet the great Che Guevara. So they got there and they managed to get an audience. And the first thing they did as they shook hands with him was they apologized for being Americans. And the great Che said to them, don't you apologize for being Americans. You see, you're the lucky ones. You get to live in the belly of the beast. His point being that stuck out in the Caribbean and Cuba, there wasn't a lot he could do to impact upon what was going on in the mainstream of the world. Whereas when you're actually in the belly of the beast, you're on the cutting edge of the potential for change. And I would say that that's how as a human species we are just now. Right now, we are living in that uncomfortable belly of the beast. We are living in the jaws of the tiger. But that is a powerful place for becoming aware and for deepening what it means to be human, to carry the future forward.
There's some all too familiar scenes of fighting between police and demonstrators.
Is this a symbol of our children's future? A future of struggle as our world unravels at the seams? Is this how things will get changed? The philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer said we are all just animals, getting along with our lives. Can we grow to be something other than this?
There's a quote from Henry Thoreau. We don't ride on the railroad, it rides us.
One of the problems is that the current economic system is based on volume and production. Very simple principle that the more you produce and sell, the more money you make. And it's a constant acceleration of production. And part of that is market share and keeping up with competition and kind of outdoing and beating competitors, which is survival. It's Darwin. It's normal. But part of it is also a blindness to other possibilities.
I don't think it's possible to disengage the emotional appeal or the emotional aspect from an evolved disposition that was selected for because of its survival and reproduction. Our brains, if you will, our minds are shaped by the thousands of years that we lived in an environment where those who were more concerned with their status, who put more effort into it, are the ones whose genes we've inherited. Right, so it's not something we can step away from. But I also do think that it's not that those things cannot be, if you will, shaped and modified by our ideology. They certainly can. We are probably the most flexible species in both the way we think, how we derive satisfaction, as well as our behaviors. And so the fact that we have these evolved tendencies, I don't think we should think of that as a sentence, if you will, that we cannot change what we value or how we behave.
Eric Fromm talks about the distinction between having and being, which is important in this context, because although the two are linked, and you could say it's they kind of play off one another and feed off one another in some instances, there is an important distinction that being describes not necessarily an acceptance, but more of just a state of engagement with you and your life and how things are, your kind of being, your As Fromm says, you're doing not doing. Whereas having is more of a positing those internal values and aspirations and existences within things around you. And it's a more, I would say it's a more remote process is having, but it's also a very unstable and stressful process because you're essentially investing yourself in everything other than yourself. Your existence is basically vomited out of you onto this table full of things, objects, that are trying to sort of help you exist, but actually don't do that at all.
Can we be free? Or, as Milan Kundera questioned, can we live lightly? Can we live instinctively, free from constraint and without expectation? It is not to be mistaken as a flight of fancy, more what it is to stand in a virgin wood and feel shivers down the spine. This is the real issue, because transition towns, recycling, alternative power, enduring design, they are just attacking the symptoms. They are merely allowing us to continue living the way we are. They are buying us time. They are not embracing the root cause, our psychology.
Alistair McIntosh, author of Hell and High Water.
In a funny way, I don't find it depressing. And I'll tell you why. I think that what we're seeing now is an inevitable stage of evolution. We are something like has never before been involved on this earth, as far as we are aware. So we're at the cutting edge of evolution. And in one sense, I see the present times we're in as almost being inevitable. It's something that had to come out of evolution, and evolution is going to have to deal with it. I would suggest mainly in cultural terms rather than biological terms. So that's what we are called to work out now. And we're working it out for the whole planet, not just for ourselves.
Jeffrey Miller,
I actually think runaway consumerism is a temporary historical glitch, a kind of exception to the human norm. For a couple million years, we did perfectly well socializing and attracting mates and raising kids through this informal face-to-face interaction, through ordinary language. And then we invented all of this stuff, all of this technology, the economy, the free market. And we realized, oh, maybe it helps us get a little bit of an advantage. I think that's actually a superficial response to technology, and I think we'll grow out of it. I think once people understand their own psychology better, we won't care as much about consumption. And I think the result will be we won't waste as much matter and energy, and we'll treat the planet a lot better.
We must acknowledge that we have become captives in a consumerist system. We cannot see the bars or understand what keeps us in. But even if we have doubts, we are swept along by the stampede around us. Things do need to change. We are wrecking the planet. But we must understand that revolution doesn't come from within a system. Revolutions are born of you and me. They may be as simple as a change of heart. They may be as difficult as saying, I've had enough.
Have we all got to become hippies? Or,
aren't we already all hippies?
Alistair McIntosh, author of Hell and High Water.
I mean, it's interesting, the whole hippie thing. I mean, leaving aside the sort of dirty hippie stereotype, you know, the kind of person who's sort of lazy, just couldn't care less. Leaving aside that, because I don't think that's what the real hippie thing is about. The real hippie thing is about being able to dance, being able to move from your hips, if you like. And I mean that metaphorically. I mean that in life. I mean that in the sense of going with the flow of life, being able to turn on to what's around you, to tune in to the deep undercurrents and to drop out of what yields death and to drop in to what gives life. And we get our politics wrong when we don't take account of that, because we think it's only about outward competitiveness and consumption that matters. We don't realize that there's much more to us, something much more beautiful to us.
And on the video, the image of the speaker was interrupted with shots of a flock of birds flying around in harmony, and the video closes with a picture of a toddler who's dancing, not to any music, just dancing in a fairly run-down looking house, ignoring any of the products behind him. He's doing his own thing. I think it's the filmmaker's attempt to point out, as Charles Eisenstein would say, that heaven begins the moment you leave the ground. That if we, humanity, would like to live in a gift economy, a world in which people don't order other people around, in which the old concepts of the rich and the poor, powerful and powerless, in which those concepts are obsolete, if we don't wish to live in a world in which those are important concepts, we should cease to treat them as important concepts, whatever anyone else does. As the film says, revolution starts with the individual, not the system, and it can be as simple as a change of heart, or as complex as saying, I have had enough. I think society is chock-a-block with people who've had enough, with people who are anxious about the future, people who really don't like the way things are going. Now, that requires some explanation when we think, well, things aren't changing very fast. I think partly that's an illusion. Things are changing much faster than we realize, remembering that commercially controlled media will be the last institution to admit of any changes going on of magnitude. And partly I think that reflects people's addiction to the status quo, to the categories of rich and poor, to the old ways of thinking which they've used all their lives. So I'd encourage you to seek inspiration from the younger generation, from those people who've been the least conditioned to the world as it is, a generation who have been connected with one another globally as no generation before, and who can listen the most clearly to their heart's view of what the world may become. If you'd like to download this show or any previous episodes, you can do so from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. We have a Twitter feed announcing new episodes at twitter.com/unwelcomeguests. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope this show has helped you to understand people's addiction to the consumer treadmill, and that it'll help you to spread the message. We have to move from knowing something is wrong to speaking and doing, to dancing out the truth that we have had enough.